What's new in your world?
What's not? Finally back from vacation, and I've got to quit pretending to myself that I'm actually going to get anything worthwhile accomplished while I'm on vacation, other than vacation itself, because it just never happens. Alrighty, here goes nothing.
What are you doing to me?
I'm sprinkling magic pixie dust over the podcast.
Okay. The weird things you do when you forget that the camera's on, Joe.
Planet Earth, an age of abundance. It's an era of entertainment in which mankind suffers from a loss of direction and a paralyzing plethora of leisure choices. Only the Vox Duo can navigate the deluge of delight that is the Golden Age.
Why, hello, Adam. It's 2 weeks later since it was the last time we talked, and here we are again.
Right on. How do you like them apples, Vox Populi? And all credits really goes to Joe here, whose editing skills not only increase over time, but become more efficient. You can knock out these episodes at this point, man.
I'm getting better at it. That is certainly true. You do something long enough and it starts to get into a little bit of a routine.
So, not so long ago, we decided to introduce each other to canon, if you will, from the great, what would you call literature as applied television? TV canon, anyway, we'll say. Things that we had missed over time that are too good to miss. And these aren't, particularly hidden gems. In fact, they rate really highly on IMDb and IMDb, if you take a look. But, it's stuff without which one's education is not complete. So Joe gave me The West Wing, the Aaron Sorkin penned political drama from the late 1990s and the early 2000s. And I in turn tossed him the first season of The Wire, David Simon's hard, unflinching look at the drug war in Baltimore. And we started off by watching a couple of episodes each, just to get the feel for it and give each other our first impressions. And we'll provide a link to that episode. And now we are going to reconvene, having watched the first season of each drama, and let each other know what we thought. That about got it right, Joe?
Yeah, that about got it right. And we have to give you credit for doing twice the work for this episode that I've done, since The West Wing is a typical late 90s TV show with a full run of 24 episodes, and The Wire is a more modern TV show with a limited run of just 13 episodes for season one.
That did occur to me. I was like, Joe really screwed me here. But time flies when you're having fun, and The West Wing was a lot of fun to watch, so it wasn't that difficult.
Well, and it turns out the joke's on me a little bit, because you've just finished The West Wing season one, so you are speaking from coming off of that experience with everything fresh in your mind, whereas I finished season one of The Wire 3 or 4 weeks ago, and I've been watching other stuff since, so I had to go back and do a little bit of memory refreshing for this episode.
Yeah, I can see that. Moreover, I think you have it a little harder, not only in that you watched it a while back, but that The Wire juggles a lot of plates. Plot developments I didn't catch to the second time I watched it. I mean, plot developments, not like Easter eggs or anything. Just like, oh, that's what happened. So I think really a watching comprehension test of sorts is what The Wire is good for. All right, well, let's get going. Was there any entertainment news that you wanted to mention before we begin? I'll note that the marvelous Miss Maisel, which I think I've pumped for on this podcast before, is getting a second season. It's been signed up for a third, so I have a lot to look forward to there. Star Wars is going to get the Game of Thrones treatment on the a forthcoming Disney Channel. They're going to do a 10-episode series. It's going to be ungodly expensive. Exactly what you imagine, I expect. But it's going to be one of their big front-running offerings.
And The Man in the High Castle, Season 3, finally got a release date from Amazon. That is coming to us in early October. I am already eagerly awaiting that. I see that Better Call Saul Season 4, I believe we're up to now, just started a week or two back. So that's now running and waiting for me to take a look at it.
I've been thinking about just mulling over the idea of actually watching it week to week. I don't know if I want to. I love being able to binge watch and just catch the next episode, at least, you know, the next night. What do you think?
I think I did watch it week to week last season, and it was kind of a fun experience. There's something to be said for binging, for being able to get that immediate gratification of seeing the next episode. But I also found there was something nice about having something to look forward to each week of, oh, hey, it's the day for the new episode of Better Call Saul, something to sit down and enjoy, and having a little bit of that anticipation while waiting for the next episode to drop.
Well, it would be appropriate. The last show that I watched week to week, because I was just that big of a fan, was, of course, Breaking Bad. Well, maybe we can do a Better Call Saul update or something as we go. That might be a fun little future project.
Something to look forward to. I think the biggest news both of us have forgotten about, and for you it's a little more understandable because you've not been much of a Star Trek fan. For me, it's inexcusable to forget about this. Patrick Stewart is going to be reprising his role as Captain Picard on a new Star Trek show made for CBS's streaming-only CBS All Access channel.
Oh, yeah. Boy, they've got your number, don't they?
I have mixed feelings about this show, honestly. Patrick Stewart is not getting any younger to any extent that he might have been an action character in Star Trek The Next Generation's original run. He's, I think, aged well beyond that at this point. And to me, it feels a little bit like a nostalgia grab, grabbing Star Trek fans who want the comfortable, want the familiar, want to see again what they've already seen before. And, you know, I'm a little bit afraid it's not going to be actually that good of a show. The only thing I'm holding on to is that Patrick Stewart has said that it is not going to be a show that is going back to what we've already seen, but it's going to be about Jean-Luc Picard at a different point in his life, a much older, later point in his life. So I'm a little bit curious what that looks like, and if they actually do explore that angle of him, just something other than him being a starship captain, it could end up being something worth watching.
Yeah, I think so, and I'm not a particularly big fan of the Star Trek franchise in general. You know, it seems to me that so long as you're not just trying to put on the same show again, that there's a lot to be mined from seeing this cast of characters, however many end up showing up long afterwards.
Exactly, and I think we should point out, as Patrick Stewart himself clarified, there really isn't much of anybody officially attached to this project yet. It's something that they want to do and they're going to move forward with doing, but nobody's really been cast. Nobody's really been firmly hired to do the work. And they've got some list of names for the writer's room, but I don't think there's any clear idea yet of how much writing each person's going to be doing. I did see that Michael Chabon is going to be one of the writers, and he's got a pretty good reputation, so We'll see how that goes. But if he's just writing one episode, might not be so much. If he's involved with half of them, you might be able to look forward to it a little bit more.
Right. Well, so if he's in the writer's room, it's a better writer's room. That much can be said. But then again, you never know. Under the Dome should have been great. I mean, it had Brian K. Vaughan as the showrunner of it, and I never even watched it, but everything I heard about it was that it just really went to heck.
Right. Yeah, you never know till you know. So I guess we'll know in 1 to 3 years how this new Star Trek series is going to come out. And until then, we'll have to entertain ourselves with Better Call Saul and with Man in the High Castle.
And next year with Lock and Key and with Why the Last Man, for that matter.
Boy, the days, they are just packed. Never enough time for all the nothing you want to do.
It's a golden age, you might say.
You might say. So speaking of which, let's talk about the West Wing. But before we talk about the West Wing, let's introduce our listeners to a new omnipresent feature of this show, which is the spoiler gong. Because as our listeners may have become aware over the last 13, 14 episodes, this is a show that is filled with spoilers. We really don't make that much of an effort to leave you spoiler-free. This is really only a show you should listen to if you either don't care about being spoiled or if you've already watched something and just want to get our input on it. So, to make this all official, we're about to discuss a spoiler-filled discussion of The West Wing Season 1.
And I realize that this is becoming sort of a mutual appreciation episode, but you really got to hand it to Joe because... finding that gong and rolling it into his little studio and everything is just above and beyond, in my personal opinion. Well done there.
I'm just ripping off better podcasts that have come before me.
Well, don't name them. All right, so let's talk about the West Wing. Yes, you know, as I watched it, obviously I had a lot of what you told me about it running through my mind, of course. And what you said was dead on. I think if you were to boil this whole show down into a one-sentence logline, it's the fantasy of the real deal, as it's called in Season 2, Episode 1, being in the office and acting like it. It's that great idea of a heroic and morally unambiguous figure coming in and running things right. I think if you want comparisons, you might go back to Dave, except it's more real than that, and it tries to be more real than that.
Wasn't Aaron Sorkin involved in that in some way, or am I misremembering here?
Was he? That would make
I
sense.
Think he was involved in one of those presidential movies that involved a good-hearted person rising to the top office.
There's a Korean version of Dave, essentially, in which a like-a-look becomes the emperor back in the Joseon dynasty. That's also really good. You know, it's a common trope at this point, but as I've always have time for it, much like a heist movie. So the great strengths of this show, and I realize I'm not saying anything new, but what I love about it is how it successfully keeps a baseline that is interesting all on its own. You know, they're usually dealing with bureaucratic stuff and votes on issues that are not necessarily world-shaking. Important, but not necessarily world-shaking or nation-shaking stuff. The kind of stuff that you can see yourself not paying attention to if it were happening in real life because you're too busy living and working and then watching good television. And what's so great about that is not only that it, you know, it gives you so much more material to work with and lets you talk about a lot of interesting things, but that when... that rare bit of violence does occur, or even the hint of it, it's actually intense and effective. And here I'm not just thinking of the season one cliffhanger, but also of the president's daughter nearly getting into trouble at a bar. So that's really cool. Going a little bit deeper, it's really interesting, and I mean, obviously, I was still a kid in the 90s, but I noticed a fair number of their signals, stories that take their cue and even use real-life decisions by the Clintons as sort of a jumping-off point. The first episode, of course, has the whole Cuban refugee point, for example. And it makes me wonder what Bush era episodes are like, whether the show kind of doubles down as, you know, this alternate universe where some decent people are still trying to run a moderate government, or whether it it kind of tacks a little bit more conservative because Sorkin is gone.
It definitely retains its liberal edge as we get into more of the Bush years. There is ways in which it ceases echoing the Clinton White House and begins critiquing the Bush White House in a number of ways, still keeping the overall tone of the show. But if you're watching it with historical awareness, you'll kind of be able to pick out the beats where it's like, okay, I see what you did there.
Yeah, it's interesting how this is potentially two different shows. Like, you know, the first seasons are what the Clintons were supposed to be. And then there's the second part of the show, which is, you know, this lost era of democratic rule, in theory, to contrast with what's happening in the world right now. It seems like a show that over the course of its run would end up making two different points.
Yeah, and in a way it kind of does, and I don't know how much of that is related to Aaron Sorkin leaving. I mean, I would definitely say it's a good show after Aaron Sorkin leaves. It's a brilliant show before Aaron Sorkin leaves. You will notice a change when you get to the point where he left the show. And the quality drops off a little bit, but with a show like The West Wing, even if the quality drops off a little bit, it's still a good show.
Moving on, characters in general are, well, I mean, the characters in general are very likable, as you said they would be. There are so many enjoyable people on this show. I definitely get your love for Toby Ziegler. He's probably the most consistently amusing. I think Josh Lyman is my preferred protagonist in general, because he's not as stupid as Sam. What he does is easier to... His actions are easier to buy, but he's still quirky and funny and frequently off his game for various reasons. In fact, those three, I'd say, Josh, Toby, and Leo are probably the characters that I most enjoy the screen time of. And then you get the president on top of that.
Yeah, and I think my love for Toby partly comes because he's the most misanthropic of all of the characters on the show. And that's something I can really identify with. He's brilliant, which I'd like to think that I am at times. And he's witty, but he's very acerbic and cutting and just in general misanthropic. He's, you know, he's not the cuddly kind of guy. And while you're right that Josh may be the... kind of easiest character to like, I think I just identify with Toby more, which is why he edges out as my favorite character on the show.
Sure. I also like the general quirkiness. One of the fun things that Sorkin does is that he takes the opportunity to dredge up all these enjoyable little details or ideas, or introduce a few of his own. The fiction show as trivia, or the fiction book as filled with trivia, is something I really like. I occasionally see a reviewer complain that, you know, an author or a TV writer is just dropping in too many interesting facts, but I generally can't get enough of that sort of thing. In fact, this reminds me, because a review just flashed before my eyes, I don't know why I ever suggested that you read Why the Last Man by Brian K. Vaughan when I don't think you've read Ex Machina.
I read the first couple of issues of that because you had recommended that to me at some point. So I did, I think, read the first five or six issues, the first actual little self-contained story.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so the mayor of New York, you know, and Vaughan's filled with that sort of thing on the municipal level, which is interesting. Ducking back from that rabbit trail, I think the best idea for like a standalone episode or a special episode every season is the Big Cheese Day. I assume this keeps going, right? They do it again in the second season?
Oh, it keeps going, and they keep playing it for gags with how much the staff hates it and how much Leo likes it. And I'm still not quite sure if Leo likes it just because it's a great idea or if Leo partially likes it just because he gets to torture his staff with it.
It's a great idea, and in researching for this episode, I found out that the Obama administration did a virtual Big Cheese Day. That's charming, and the Obama administration was nothing if not charming.
And it's worth summarizing for our listeners exactly what Big Cheese Day is, because Leo always pulls the staff into the office at the beginning of the day and starts off with a set speech.
Andrew Jackson, in the main foyer of his White House, had a big block of cheese. The block of cheese was huge, over 2 tons. And it was there for any and all who might be hungry. Jackson wanted the White House to belong to the people, so from time to time he opened his doors to those who wished an audience. It is in the spirit of Andrew Jackson that I, from time to time, ask senior staff to have face-to-face meetings with those people representing organizations who have a difficult time getting our attention. I know the more jaded among you see this as something rather beneath you. But I assure you that listening to the voices of passionate Americans is beneath no one. And surely not the people's servants.
Sir, we're late. Is it total crackpot day again?
Yes, it is.
Now, I think I remember once catching a YouTube video of The West Wing, just a scene from it, in what I presume to have been a Big Cheese Day episode, and it was about correcting the world map, that there were some map enthusiasts who were really irked that our maps are not, and you know, our general maps are not in any way proportioned properly.
Yeah, they get CJ well and truly freaked out over the idea that Greenland is not where she thinks it is, and that various land masses are not the size that she thinks it is.
Yes! But see, I mean, I'm with CJ. I think we need to fix this. I want to buy my little sisters a copy of the kind of map that they're advertising so that they'll put it on their little homeschooling wall and have that perspective shift. I think that was great.
Yeah, and they are out there, and in fact, maybe I'll throw some links into the show notes for this episode for listeners who are curious, but there are a couple different projections that are different from the standard globe projections that we here in America are used to, and it's somewhat surprising the size differences between the various land masses. Greenland is in fact a lot smaller than you think it is, and Africa is a lot bigger than you think it is.
Yeah, that was pretty mind-blowing. Obviously, this show is in part democratic wish fulfillment, explicitly liberal wish fulfillment. So I got pumped by the Let Bartlett Be Bartlett episode, since it's exactly what progressives like me want to see. You know what? We're going to take the gloves off and just do what's right, regardless of where the polls fall.
And the people will reward us for that, because they will see our honesty and our sincerity, and they will like it, and they will line up behind us.
Sure. And to some degree, they're right. I think the Trump administration, if nobody else, has kind of borne it out. That, you know, tacking to your base, actually, the people are people's loyalties are a lot more elastic than we give them credit for, or rather, or than we would like to believe. Of course, there's a bit of an illusion there. It's not that Democrats are particularly ineffective in office necessarily, nor Republicans. It's that they don't necessarily have the priorities that we want them to have or that we believe that they have. They're juggling multiple or a lot of different threads of input. Nevertheless, yeah, the whole idea that throughout – and that, this is one of those things. I'm going to mention a little later how subplots kind of drop off and then reappear in this show. But one thing that they did a good job of – mentioning now again was that their approval polls were kind of in the toilet, and this always came off just as background chatter for drama's sake. You know, if you're gonna add a line, or if you need to add a line about this or that, then what are you going to say? Our approval polls are great? Everything's swimming? No, you don't. You want the heroes to be sweating it out. So I just assumed it was background chatter. And to find that things come to a head in which we realize that the staff themselves are really just kind of unhappy with how things are going, and to make an actual explicit turn in light of that, I thought was a really nice move. Also, in season 2, episode 1, and episode 2, you get flashbacks in which you learn why all of the different characters joined up with the campaign. And in general, it was because they wanted to see a candidate they could believe in make a run for the Oval Office. And so it's a hindsight kind of thing and might be more rewarding on a second viewing. But I think, the sense that they're very unhappy with how things are going is more effective if you realize that this isn't why they signed up to pull their punches in the first place.
Right, they signed up looking for someone who was going to be the real deal, who was going to be the true person who actually believed what he said and didn't just say it cynically as a strategy for getting elected. And they all joined the team for that reason. And that's very definitely the theme that runs through the whole show, is this is... this is a White House staff and this is a White House president who all got into it because they really truly believed in the right thing to do. They weren't just being, the president wasn't just being a typical politician who said what was popular or what people wanted to hear. And while all of these individuals may have worked on past campaigns where they were just cynically helping someone to run for office, this time around, they got to genuinely help someone run for office, or at least genuinely believe in the candidate that they were pushing.
Right. I really like, it's a season 2 moment because I have watched the first 2 episodes of season 2 because of that cliffhanger. Ah! But I love this moment when Toby Ziegler is sitting in a bar and this woman asks him how many campaigns he's won. And he says, none. This has been his career. He's been through, he's a really experienced high roller
consultant, but he's never won a campaign. And from experience, I know this is actually kind of possible. Your star definitely rises if you win, but you can make a career out of losing.
Oh, you certainly can. And it's this idea that, Toby has been too wedded to his principles, that he keeps picking one righteous candidate after another who has no shot in the actual polls, and then he finally gets a guy who is a righteous candidate and does manage to pull it off. So the fairy tale story for Toby.
Exactly so. And we'll get into the discussion of how much of a fairy tale in politics is a good thing. Let me go through a few jarring parts. I don't even know that all of this is critique or criticism, just so much as things I noticed. So it is definitely politics for popular consumption. The staff of the White House is not that small. They're not all those 5 people are not doing all of that work. And that's fine. It's the feel of it and getting the metaphor right. You don't need to be extremely loyal to reality in that sense. At least I don't think so. You have these moments here when you realize, if you've worked in politics at all, that people have different opinions about what should be happening on the outside because they've just never – I don't know. The example I'm going to give here is in season 2, episode 1, when someone says, never say the opponent's name, and President Bartlett, or the future President Bartlett, goes off on him about how that's stupid and he's going to look like he's an old man with Alzheimer's or something. That's very standard. You don't say the opponent's name, at least in the primaries. It's free advertising. You don't want to remind people of them. You want to be the only candidate, as far as anyone knows, that exists on that stage. Why do people's homework for them? But of course, we get the opinion of the masses put in the mouth of the presidential candidate, because, you know, we want to like him. We want him to have folksy charm. So there's some of that, and it's not a criticism. I just notice it. The weight put on people's emotions. This is a surprising show in that regard. You know, your average average half-hour family sitcom is going to have someone's feelings hurt. And then over the next half hour, you know, people are going to figure out that they had accidentally hurt their sister or their brother or whatever, and they're going to come together and they're going to talk it out. Or in Gilmore Girls, which is sort of the next evolution of that, that doesn't happen, and you really just get a window into the kind of life someone's leading, but not necessarily plot development as such, just a bit different angle on it. And this show, there is more of that than you would expect from a show about people taking care of the free world. Leo's decision to keep a leaker, just because he thinks she did it for the right motivations. The White House's staff, the White House's decision to keep Leo.
But by all rights, a chief of staff that should have been fired about 5 minutes after the news came out. Or should have resigned, really.
Yeah, exactly. I'm still surprised that nobody in this show has mentioned that possibility yet. And you can explain it away as this tight-knit group's loyalty to each other, and that you're seeing things from inside the bunker. Lord knows worse political decisions have been made. but you'd think someone would mention it.
And if I'm keeping my season straight, this is the revelation that has been leaked, that Leo had at some point in the past been in treatment for addiction to alcohol and to pills.
Yes, exactly so. And then word gets out that he was addicted, and apparently it was affecting him enough to where he needed to go into rehab while he was running, I think, a department.
Department of
Labor?
Yes, Department of Labor.
Right, so he's running the Department of Labor, and also his alcoholism and also his pill addiction are out of control at this stage. That's a pretty big deal.
And this is something that would typically end a political career right then and there. You would resign from being Secretary of the Department of Labor. You would leave Washington, D.C. in disgrace. And you might rehabilitate yourself and run for some state office a couple of years in the future. But it's hard to imagine an actual national-level politician who would get away with having a pill and alcohol addiction and end up not only surviving the post he'd been in at the time, but rising to become chief of staff for a president.
Right. Certainly, it's hard to imagine, that baggage working just right then and there. I think, you know, in Washington, Washington is very forgiving, and I think there was some excitement, to my disbelief, among some friends of mine in New York about the idea of Anthony Weiner, running for office again after his first big sex-related scandal. Then it turned out that he just couldn't quit, and he ended up falling from grace again. But he was actually in serious consideration to run for another office.
And I think he was even trying to run a third time. Thankfully, that third time around, the voters were having nothing of it, and it fizzled out pretty fast. But if I remember right, he tried to come back twice.
I think you're right. Yeah, that was jaw-dropping. I could see Leo also winding up in some sort of high-powered firm, you know, some very cushy line of work. But yeah, I just can't see in the 90s him surviving that, especially not the tough on drugs era.
No, and again, this goes back to the West Wing's running theme of politics as the way it should be rather than politics as the way it is. We should be forgiving. We should give people second chances. And if people have genuinely reformed and turned their lives around, then we should forgive and we should welcome them back with open arms rather than all of this petty politics of personal destruction. And it's something that shows up in the West Wing over and over and over again.
That's fine. Really, I think that's not a bad point at all. I think that's I'd love to get to a place where we see addiction as less of a moral failing and more of just a health problem. On the other hand, I don't think you want an alcoholic or a pill addict on as your chief of staff in the White House. There's probably a line to draw there.
There's a certain level of stress where you feel like even if a person is clean, even if a person has been in recovery for 20 years, do you really want to put them in one of the 10 most stressful jobs in the world and trust that they're not going to end up diving for pills or a bottle at some point?
Right. And his wife's divorcing him.
Yeah, which is normally the thing that sends people into a downward spiral. But fortunately, Leo is a workaholic and has his job to turn to.
There you go. One of his addictions is canceling out the other. This is a very good example of how the three branches of government are supposed to work. He's a metaphor. Sorkin's a genius.
There you go.
Finally, Sam's decision to date a call girl and the fact that the White House staff allowed this to continue remains mystifying. But again, I think of a piece with its era, back when Pretty Woman was still considered a lovely rags-to-riches story.
Exactly.
But that's a good way to segue into the somewhat dated gender relations, and I'm curious as to whether I'm just a flaming liberal or you see this too?
You're definitely a flaming liberal, but no. As I was rewatching this, because I started rewatching this again last year, and there had been a gap of 5 or 6 years since the previous time that I'd seen it, and it was something that this time around jumped at me more, is what subservient roles almost all of the female characters were in, and you have throwing in here Danny Kincannon's pursuit of CJ, which is... yeah, I would say a pretty typical mid to late 90s view of gender relations and how dating should work, and something that just wouldn't quite feel right in a modern TV show. And there's nothing, I think, wrong with how Danny is treating CJ. It's just that dynamic of him being the one to pursue her and her constantly wanting him to be the one pursuing her doesn't ring quite as true anymore. People date differently these days.
Okay, growing up especially, I saw something like this a lot. Danny Kincannon, I don't know, he's not being exceptionally charming, in my opinion. He's just being sort of brave. And there's this idealized version of this where that's wholly dependent on the girl actually kind of being attracted to him, but just having some other issue, like, for example, it being CJ's job to maintain a certain distance that is causing her not to say yes. And the problem is, I think, that when you take this fairly sweet scenario and you transport it to the real world, that it very rarely turns out like that. That generally when the woman says no, she actually means it. And that if you keep acting like Danny Kincannon, that you're creating a very uncomfortable situation. That the woman, being the primary PR official, might actually have to, you know, not throw in your face at the time.
Yeah, and there's some interesting relationships in that job, and that the press secretary does have the power to throw certain reporters out of the press room, and losing your access to the regular press pool and to being able to talk to the press secretary is painful. From a professional perspective, but then there's the counter perspective that if Danny Kincannon is as big of a national reporter for the New York Times as is said and implied, shutting him out and having the press write articles in his defense could backfire on you. And so if we're talking gender relations and power imbalances, it's a little bit hard to draw the line as to who has the upper hand in that particular professional relationship. And you're
I'm
right.
I'm not thinking so much in terms of power imbalances. For me, it's more about interest and what the proper method of pursuit is. And I may just be particularly sensitive to this because I learned how to pursue women from movies and TV in my early days, because I was a homeschool kid. And it turned out to be wrong, or, you know, a lot of what I took away from it was
But I did everything that they've done. I don't understand why it didn't work for me the way it worked for them.
Well, it was a good sport about it, because sometimes, I mean, I understood that a lot of times you just got rejected. But, it's honestly one of the kind of grudges I hold against the whole setup, that, I mean, I think I could have been much more happy and just generally kind of content with how things actually worked than the way that I was taught. This seems to fall squarely within the sort of relationships that I saw back on TV in those early days.
Yeah, it does. And I think I might have jumped two or three steps ahead when I started talking about power imbalances, because I think where I thought you were going is Danny has an interest in CJ and is pursuing her, and CJ shuts him down because she's the press secretary and it's not really right to fraternize with the press in that way. And if Danny keeps pursuing her when she said no, that's where I think you start jumping into real world questions of when does it cross the line from cute romantic interest to sexual harassment at some point. And then once you start talking sexual harassment is once you start talking power imbalances. And is it sexual harassment if she has the upper hand in the relationship, or is it only when he has, and who really does have the upper hand in that relationship? And that's where I think it gets, if you transferred this relationship to the real world, where it starts to get really troublesome, because there are a lot of instances of guys who won't take no for an answer and keep pursuing women, and it does turn into a form of harassment rather than a cute romantic relationship.
Yeah, and then of course the question becomes, to what degree is a television show obligated to explore tricky questions?
Yeah, can't it just be a cute romantic relationship? Do we have to go into all these deep dive questions?
Right. I think there's a lot to ask there. I will note that there's a parallel here, that Danny Concannon's approach seems very similar to me to Sam's approach to his first love interest, the call girl, and that the first episode ends with him sort of quasi-confronting her and saying, you know, I'm here, you know, and I'm interested. And that's that. And so I think Aaron Sorkin's got a particular idea of a romantic meeting in his head. That's not a criticism. Just I noticed that the approaches were similar.
Yeah. And I keep coming back to The West Wing is inherently a fantasy. It's a very well done fantasy that borrows enough from reality to feel like a real show, an idealized version of the real world. And I think that's what you have to just accept it as. These are relationships and decisions that if you try to transport them to the real world, get all kinds of sticky and messy. But if you just look at it as a fantasy show, it's a fun relationship between Danny and CJ, or at least I think it is.
Yeah. I guess the romantic entanglements mirror, like you say, the show itself and all of its glory. Okay, so one more note I had was that, the show sort of straddles two approaches to television. It's got this halfway point between the old tendency of shows to make everything watchable out of order for the purposes of syndication, and this greater acceptance of continuity in TV that we have today. So subplots come and subplots go. Sam Seaborn's love life, for example, but they don't really hang around the margins much. Until they address a particular issue, just in general, that just doesn't exist. Like, things go off stage and they just don't come back until we're ready to see them again. So for example, you've got Sam Seaborn's love life. I think this is one area where it works really well, the approach. He's got these love interests, but from an average episode, you wouldn't know it. There is zero mention of the fact that he has a girlfriend or that he's interested in someone. And that only changes when it's time to have another development in that particular subplot. Then she comes back. And it's not like everyone needs to be reintroduced to her or anything. And faithful watchers of the show are happy to see her. But if you missed a particular week, that's okay. You wouldn't feel like you missed anything the next week.
Yeah, that's... You're right. It's very much straddling two eras of TV shows, and I don't know that I have much to add other than to say I enjoyed when I watched it, because I think continuously running plot lines were a new thing to me at the time I watched The West Wing. So to me, it was a new thing. It was an exciting thing having storylines, plot elements that kept popping back up in different episodes. And looking back on it now, it's surprising to the extent to which episodes don't connect together. But it was maybe a little bit of a cutting edge show at the time.
Yeah. Okay. It's funny when you say cutting edge, it's that may have been when it really started to enter the popular consciousness. I don't know. I don't have my TV dates down because I'm not really a TV scholar.
I know you had Babylon 5 was very tightly plotted, and that was mid-90s at some point. And you had Star Trek Deep Space Nine, which ripped off a lot of stuff from Babylon 5, including the idea of tightly written plots. And that was also mid to late 90s. So West Wing wasn't necessarily leading the trend, but... it was one of a handful of shows that were starting to weave better continuity through their episodes.
I may be wrong, but I think it was Twin Peaks that first pioneered that whole idea of a show with one long-running plot line. And that was 1990 to 1991. It had this amazing shooting star-like popularity where it was the hottest thing on television for 1 year, and then it couldn't get arrested by the end of its second season. But that was just sort of a harbinger, I think, of what was to come. It's not like it led to this sea change in television. So I think it's still fair to say that these shows that were doing more connected plots were riding a new wave.
Yeah, I'll go with that.
Okay. I wanted to ask if, you had anything more to say on this topic that we keep sort of butting up against. I think, you know, if there's one good question to ask, it's the one that you keep accidentally asking whenever you're discussing anything else. And it's, to what degree is the dissonance in The West Wing between the illusion that the show promotes and the reality a good thing? Apparently, Josh Lyman is based on Rahm Emanuel, who... everything I've heard about suggests is kind of a gross creature. Maybe kind of a Peter in the Mad Men, in the sense that, you know, personally he's kind of loathable, even though he maybe is effective and generally right about his politics. I tend to be very contemptuous of people in general who see real life politicians as pure as characters on TV shows, because there are true believers out there, as we well know. And I just don't understand how they get it, where this hero worship comes from. It's like, it's just devoid of context to me. And you can be a good person and still be somewhat morally and still do morally ambiguous things. I think when we start discussing The Wire, we'll get into that. Or you can have opinions that aren't 100% right and so forth. I am not such a fundamentalist in these questions. But I'm curious as to what you think about The West Wing's place in all that. Is it a tonic for cynicism about our political arena? Or is it ruining people a little bit by disguising the reality of how things get done?
I'm a little bit of a romantic at heart. So I tend to like shows which romanticize and show the positive side of things, or show a more positive than reality version of the world. And The West Wing is certainly that, and that may explain why it's one of my favorite shows of all time. I believe that myths are important to a society. You need to have something to believe in, and whether George Washington and Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and the rest of the founding fathers were as pure as the driven snow as we'd like to think they were or not, to me, is a less important question than whether or not we need to have pure as the driven snow characters to look up to and to emulate. And I think to a certain degree we do. If the mythical George Washington is different from the historical George Washington, well, it's not at all a bad thing to have the mythical George Washington as someone that we're trying to emulate in our personal lives and in our politics. And I think that has to be balanced. I almost feel like you have to be able to hold two different ideas in your head at the same time. You need to know the historical George Washington as he was in reality. You need to be anchored in reality and to know what's actually possible and what's not, and to know where the cliffs and ravines are so that you don't just step off the edge and plummet to your death. But you also need to have something that you can aspire to. And so when I look at the West Wing, I'm well aware of all of the downsides to politics. I mean, that's part of the reason why I'm a libertarian, is I don't believe any politician can be trusted with any degree of power without hedging them around with all kinds of restrictions and barriers. But I like the romantic vision of politicians who are statesmen, who are there trying to achieve the greatest good for the greatest number of people, who are trying to do the right thing, even if it hurts them politically, or even if it hurts their career advancement. And so the West Wing, to me, is the mythos of what American politics should be. And that's good and that's fine, as long as you're also aware of what it is that the truth of American politics actually is.
Okay. That was well spoken, ex tempore, man. I thought, well said.
Thank you.
I think that's about all I have for the West Wing. I suppose this is the point where we talk about whether I'll keep going, but I already admit I have. I'm through with season 2, episode 1, and a little bit into episode 2 right now because, of course, I had to know what happened after the cliffhanger.
It was a very effective cliffhanger.
It was indeed. One difference between The Wire and The West Wing that I'll note is that it's very much an ongoing, somewhat episodic saga. There's something wonderful about the complete... about the coincidence that, you know, the general presidential term is 8 years if you successfully get reelected. So if the West Wing keeps going, you know, and manages to knock out all 7 of those seasons, then, you know, that about conforms to a whole presidential administration quite well. So I think it's in that way, too. It has its cake and it eats it. That it, you know, quite naturally, that would be a timeline for a president.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think season 7 does a good job of a huge chunk of the plot line of season 7 is electing the next administration. And I think it does a good job of showing the reality of the last year or two of a presidential administration is kind of a crippled one, because everyone who has ambitions to advance kind of deserts the White House once a president can no longer be reelected and turns to who's the next guy to go work for. And season 7 of The West Wing shows that, again, in a romantic, rose-colored glasses kind of way, but it does match up well with the reality of what happens as things are winding down in one White House and getting ready to spin up in the next.
Oh, I do think that sounds interesting. What happens to a show when your hero is the lame duck?
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know what general fan perspective is on season 7, but I rather like season 7 for that perspective. And I've got to say, for season 2, if you enjoyed season 1, if you loved season 1, season 2 is much the same. The episodes are very, very high quality. It's not retreading old ground, but it's just, you know, you get another 20-some episodes of really high-quality television in front of you.
What's your favorite season?
I would say in general, the first two seasons overall, I think those are the absolute highest quality of the show, and season three is good, don't get me wrong, but I think season three and season four is when you can see the show take a half step down, and so seasons one and two combined just kind of flow for me really smoothly of 40-some episodes of great television.
All right. Well, I look forward to watching it, and while I don't think we'll be doing another show like this about The Wire and The West Wing specifically, unless we get a lot further along, I am looking forward to talking about it with you.
Fantastic. So, The Wire. I find it very interesting that you were watching a show that is very much a fantasy depiction of the world, and I was watching a show that is very much not a fantasy depiction of the world. It is gritty and realistic and hard-hitting and cutting and any other adjective you want to throw in there. The Wire is life.
Yeah, I had thought of that, actually, yes, that you were giving me the fantasy and I was giving you the punch to the nuts.
And in some ways, we were exchanging what our typical preferences are. You've been watching what is more my typical preference in television, and I've been watching what seems to be more your wheelhouse.
That's an interesting thought, because when we first not came together, I mean, we've always kind of been in contact, but certainly when we really got back into talking, you know, you were still the sci-fi fantasy nerd altogether, and I had kind of jumped with both feet into great with big L literature, you know, it was much more interested in the real world. So I guess The Wire and The West Wing do kind of reflect that tendency that we still have.
And so my overall impression of The Wire, having seen all of season one, is it is, and I'm sorry, this is cliched and nothing nobody else has not said a million times before, it's a very good show. It's a very, very good show. And, you know, the ingredients that I think make for a good show is casting. Is everybody, are all of the actors and actresses believable as the characters they're playing? And this one knocks that out of the park. And it's writing. Does the words people say and the way they interact, does that feel real and reflect reality? And this absolutely does. This feels like real people interacting. So it's a very, very good show. It hits every note it's supposed to hit as far as quality goes, and absolutely nails it. And I'm discovering, you know, as you said, I've always been a huge sci-fi fantasy reader, and you had, in the time we were a little bit more out of contact, you'd morphed into a big L literature reader. And I still haven't made the jump to appreciating literature when it comes to the books I read. But I've discovered that I'm absolutely a sucker for literary TV shows. Something about, and this is something I'd like to discuss more in another context, maybe dive into it a bit. What I find boring and tedious in a book, I find enthralling on the screen, watching it being played out. And maybe this just indicates I have a dearth of imagination and I need to see it in order to appreciate it. But I do. I enjoy literature. And The Wire, to me, felt like literature on television. It was as much about the characters and their individual stories as it was about the actual police investigation that was happening in West Baltimore.
Well, all right. I actually have an advantage in this discussion, too. I don't know how recently you watched an episode of The West Wing, but I actually watched The Wire season one again all of last month because my wife was interested, and I knew I was going to be having this discussion with you. Although there was a deal made, my wife also wanted me to watch something she quite liked and also kind of wanted to rinse out her brain after every episode. So I've been involved in this very schizophrenic television viewing habit in which I follow up each episode of The Wire with one of the Great British Baking Show. So
yeah, that's
yeah, this is my night. It's like he was the boy, they just called from the station. The boy is blind in one eye. Followed by, oh, it's a nice even bake. But if you left it in the oven longer to prove, you wouldn't have had that, you know, slightly doughy center.
What the detectives talk about when they go home at the end of the day.
Yeah. Anyhow, so it's going to be I've been blessed in that I've gotten to hear multiple people's opinions of one of my favorite television shows of all time here. And what Anna said is much like what you said, that it felt like a novel on television and a complete story. If there were no additional seasons, she would have been perfectly satisfied with it.
Yeah, and that's actually one of the questions I'm going to ask you at the end of this conversation. But I'll pause that one. I think the question I'm most interested in right now is this one. You said Anna was interested in watching The Wire. Was it, in fact, our podcast that made her interested in watching The Wire, or was this just outside influence and we turn out to have no listenership?
Yeah, actually, I think she may have mentioned it, or she said that if I was going to watch it again, that she wanted to do it too, because you know she'd been hearing me talk about it for quite some time, and Anna's always interested in sort of sharing these sort of things as couple building material, but she does listen, and she was aware that you were watching it.
There you go. I'll assume that we had some influence, that our discussion. I will assume that our discussion is what tipped her over the edge.
I think I know at least one person who ended up watching Sense8 as well because of a discussion previously about some of our favorite shows.
And I think someone who also ended up retweeting one of our tweets. So potentially we got a new follower or fan.
Hurrah!
There we go. So what did I like about The Wire? I actually broke this down by thinking back over, now that I am a month or two removed from having watched the show, when I think back of The Wire, what is it that pops up in my mind? What are the scenes that really stuck with me for one reason or another? And so I made a list of a scene, generally a scene from an episode or a scene from every other episode that stuck out in my mind and that illustrate for me what it is that I appreciated about The Wire.
Oh, cool. All right. Let's hear it.
So I'm going to mention this scene from episode one, not because it really stuck out in my mind, but because it ties into the end of the show and it's necessary to set up the context.
Mm-hmm.
There is a scene in episode one where McNulty, the detective who's one of the leads of the show, is talking to his sergeant. Yes, talking to his sergeant. And his sergeant is giving him a chewing out for having pushed an investigation into the Barksdale drug gang. And his sergeant is warning him of the ways that this is going to go badly for McNulty.
Well, where don't you want to go, asshole? Evidence control? Personnel? Headquarters security?
The boat? The marine unit?
Yeah, those diesel fumes that make me feel seasick.
That's good. Keep it up. I'll go this against a 10. You're riding the boat midnight shift.
And this is just a conversation that I didn't even really notice it when I was watching through the show. I didn't really pick up on it until I came back to it, piecing stuff together in preparation for this conversation. But I'm going to throw it out here, and now all of the listeners know that it is important. It does matter. What actually stuck out to me in episode one was one of the street characters is named Bubbles, an African-American gentleman who ends up helping out the police quite a bit. And he's a drug addict, and he's got a friend, a white guy named Johnny, who's also a drug addict. And Johnny's younger and, shall we say, less intelligent or less street savvy than Bubbles is.
Mm-hmm, and he's still green.
Still green, and he tries to pull off a con on the drug dealers of passing fake currency in order to buy drugs that he can't actually afford. And Johnny, not being as slick as Bubbles, gets caught and then proceeds to get the crap beat out of him by the drug dealers. And this is a scene that, as soon as I watched it, stuck out with me because I read way too much economics and spend too much time thinking economics. And what immediately jumped out to me is this is the consequence of having drugs made illegal. If this were a normal commercial transaction and someone tries to rip you off, you catch them, you place a call to the cops, they get arrested, they get processed. You know, there's a whole societal structure for how you handle criminal behavior. But because we've made the mere act of taking drugs a criminal behavior, there is no way for the drug dealers to use the criminal system to protect themselves against theft. And so they protect themselves against theft the only way that they can. If you get caught, you get the crap beat out of you. If you do something too egregious, you die. And that being at the very beginning of The Wire, right there in season one, just really drove home when I watched it, and still as I think back over it, that the drug war is a complete waste because it increases the violence in society. There is nowhere for people to go to resolve disputes in the legal system, and so you increase the violence in the extra legal system that surrounds it.
I think, you know, the difference between shows that incidentally show things in which we, you know, impart our own meaning on, and the difference between shows which are actually talking about issues is whether they flag these things. And I remember in the first couple episodes, you know, several times that what you're talking about is flagged, that D is frequently ruined. He says, you know, why it got to be like that? Why, you know, everything else gets sold without bodies dropping. And the reason that the police keep coming down is because we keep dropping bodies.
Yeah, course, exactly. If we weren't dropping bodies, they wouldn't be down here harassing.
Yeah, of course, if the police were serving them, then they wouldn't have to drop the bodies. It's all this one big cockamamie system.
Yeah.
It's funny. Since we're still on episode one real quick, let me bring you back to the prologue, the very first episode. Because in the first time we talked about this, what stuck with you was that whole charming snot boogie discussion of how people get these ludicrous street names, and, you know, life be unfair sometimes, I guess. But the big encapsulation of the whole season is that story about Snot Boogie being allowed to play the gambling game every week, and every week at some point trying to run away with the proceeds, and every week getting his butt beat for it. And McNulty saying, why'd you let him play? Got to. This is America. And just, you know, this not working, but being stuck in the cycle, you know, it, that's the season right there.
That's
anyway.
America. Everybody's got to get a chance to try again, even if it ain't working.
And I won't run away with you all of these. All right, cool. Yeah, so beating Bubbles Attic friend.
Yeah. Next moment that stuck out was in episode three, when D'Angelo comes across Wallace and another guy playing checkers on a chessboard using chess pieces because they don't know how to play chess. And Wallace walks over to him and says, no, you can't be playing checkers on a chessboard. And chess is a far better game anyway. Let me show you how to play. And he proceeds to go through each of the different pieces on the chessboard, relating it to what they're familiar with, life in a gang and all the different positions in a gang, starting out with picking up the king.
See this? This the kingpin, all right? And he the man. You get the other dude's king, you got the game. And he trying to get your king too, so you got protected. Now the king, he move one space any direction he damn choose, cause he's the king. Like this, 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 all right? But he ain't got no hustle.
And talking through who the queen is, and of course the king is his uncle, Avon Barksdale, who's the head of this whole thing. And the queen, she's the one that can move everywhere. She's got all the action. She's got all the moves. That's Stringer Bell, Avon Barksdale's chief lieutenant. All the way down to...
These are the pawns. They like the soldiers. And they like the front lines. They be out in the field. Pawns, man, in the game, they get capped quick. They be out the game early.
And it's a fun scene. honestly, I'm not a chess player, and I tend to have not much interest in chess, but watching that scene and watching that relation of who everybody is and thinking of chess in that different light made me more interested in playing chess than I have been in the whole past decade. and it struck me on multiple levels, because it struck me as one is there's a lot of times in which we get too locked in to the standard method of teaching something or the standard method of explaining something, and you miss really creative opportunities for how to get people engaged. I mean, how many kids, if you taught them chess this way, would find chess a far more interesting game than the standard way it's taught? But the second thing was how well that little scene put life in a gang into perspective, that you've got the Avon Barksdales and you got the Stringer Bells who are at the top of the chain and got all the power and the money's coming to them and the benefits are accruing to them and they don't got nothing to worry about. And then you got the pawns all the way down at the projects running the drugs. They're the ones that are going to get shot. They're the ones that are going to get killed. They're the ones that are going to get taken out early. And it's only episode 3. And that puts a sense of tragedy over the whole rest of the show, because you know it's true. You know these are the pawns you're looking at, and you know that no matter what else happens, it's not going to end well for them.
Yeah, full stop. That's one of the iconic scenes of The Wire. That's one of those scenes that set it up for the long run. Great stuff.
Episode 4, one that you had warned me about, that I just refer to as the F-bomb investigation scene.
Oh, yeah, we watched the first two episodes when yes, we originally introduced each other to this, and you're like, I'm not used to the language yet.
I got to this one, and it's McNulty and his partner Bunk. They've been given an old homicide to investigate that may or may not be related to their case, but they've been asked to take a second look at it. And the detective who originally took a first look at it is, you know, kind of a slack off. So they knew there might be something there to look at. But they walk into this apartment where a murder had taken place, and they spend the entirety of the 5-minute scene putting pictures down on the floor, drawing circles on the ground to illustrate where body parts or bullet holes had been, pulling out tape measures and measuring distances and angles and heights, and going through this whole investigation. And pretty much the only dialogue that's used is variations of the F word by both of them over and over, different tones of voice, different speed, different emphasis, and it is amazing how much gets communicated in that scene with essentially one word of dialogue to work with. It's some of the most beautiful writing and acting I think I've ever seen. It was, and it's not a word you use often with this kind of language, it was sublime.
I'm so glad you liked that. I was really curious as to whether you would hate it or whether you would think that that was just glorious. Yeah, you're right. So much gets said. It's, you know, it's flipping poetry. and what really makes that scene work, I always thought this was clever, is that you know how the murder happened.
Yes.
And usually that's not helpful, because if you want a dramatic story, you don't want to explain how the murder happened before you have the detectives arrive on the scene. But since we already had D explain how the woman got shot, you already know what they're looking at, and their gestures work.
Yeah, is they're putting it all together, and it gives you an appreciation. It's a little scene that gives you an appreciation for the fact that these guys actually are good detectives. It's, you know, the old show don't tell thing. If all the show did was tell us that these guys were great detectives, it doesn't have as much impact as watching them walk into this apartment and in the space of about 5 minutes reconstruct the crime scene and figure out how it had happened and dig out a bullet shell that had previously been unfound, just because they're standing there looking at everything and putting together the angles and the clues.
Yeah. And we've said this before already, even this podcast, but I really like not just clever people doing clever things, but I like learning about how things are done. And so it's really interesting to see how detectives do their jobs.
Right. Absolutely. Next scene that stuck out to me was at the end of episode 4. McNulty and Freeman go into a bar and have a conversation about Freeman's past and why it is that he'd been stuck in the pawn shop division for 17 years, because Bunk has told McNulty that Freeman's actually a good detective, a natural police, but why has he been stuck in pawn shop for 17 years? And we get this whole story of where Freeman was working as a detective and had cracked a case and had a witness he was going to put on the stand, that he'd gotten instructions from higher up in the police department. He was not to put this witness on the stand. There was no need to drag this kid's name into it and to humiliate this particular father. We could do the case without him. And Freeman puts him on the stand and uses him to nail the case shut. And then he says, the major comes to me afterwards and asks me, there's going to be fallout, there's going to be repercussions, but comes back to me and asks me where I want to go. And then he comes back again.
Well, the major come back and asks me where I don't want to go. And he asks him, like, you want to make sure I land okay. So I tell him, I don't want no fucking paper shuffle. No office shit. I send my black ass outside and let me police somewhere.
Pawn shop unit.
No. They got me good, huh?
Where all he's doing is pushing papers for 17 years as punishment for having done the job, essentially. And so the advice he gives to McNulty is, when they ask you where you want to go, keep your mouth shut.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, just to be clear, I didn't see where this was going back in the... Or I hadn't been putting these connections together the first time I watched this season. The quote in episode 1, where don't you want to go, asshole? This episode, I think there's so much going on at The Wire that I think you definitely miss things the first time. So I think it was on my second view that I realized what was going on here, and this thread kind of came to light. Did you notice?
I essentially missed this thread when it happened. It wasn't until we got to the very last episode, one of the very last scenes of the last episode, where McNulty, in fact, ends up on a Marine boat as part of the Marine unit, that this suddenly vividly came back to me. I thought it was nice in that it was a scene, that it was a low-key personal interaction, giving you a little bit of insight into two characters, but you kind of gloss over it because it doesn't seem to be part of the main plot until all of a sudden you get to the end, and then it's like a buried memory resurfacing. Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay, got it. I can't remember. You may have done better than me. I may have completely forgotten that he hated the Marine life by then.
I had completely forgotten that he'd hated the Marine life by then. It wasn't until I saw him on the boat that it came back to me and remembered. And then I still had to go back and look up. I thought he'd said he hated the Marine life in this conversation in the bar. But I looked up and found out, no, it was actually, in fact, talking to the sergeant back in episode 1.
Okay.
I have a question about this we're going to come to at the end of the discussion.
Okay. Well, nice work, detective.
Next moment that sticks out, episode 5, Presbyluski. A by all appearances, complete screw-up, who the only reason he's on the squad is because his dad or his uncle is a high-ranking person in the Baltimore Police Department. And Presbyluski looks like just a complete waste of space. Until they've been trying to get on the pagers and figure out when... people in the gang are getting calls on their pagers and the numbers are being left on the pager. What do the numbers refer to? Because they're not active phone numbers. And it's Presbyluski who figures out the code for the pagers. He likes word search puzzles. He's taken a picture or made a photocopy of a telephone keypad, and he's worked at it until he's figured out what the code is. And it's actually a clever little code that involves looking at the way the keypad on a telephone is laid out and jumping one number over another to decode the message. And as Presbyluski says, look, it can't be a complicated code. It can't involve math or algebra or anything like that, or else these little kids down in the projects wouldn't be able to figure it out and wouldn't be able to keep it straight. It's got to be simple. And it's Presbyluski who ends up pulling it together and has a couple of other insights later in the case that really help them out. And I think you'd warned me when I was watching the show that there's going to be some characters that you don't like that turn out to be better than you thought they were. And Przybylowski was that for me. And that moment in episode 5 is where he turns from, yeah, he's kind of a screw up, but at the same time, he's smart. If you find what he's good at, he can be an asset.
Yes. There's this great moment late in the season. I don't remember where, I think it's like even the last episode or the second to last episode. Cause the police raid the main stash of the Barksdale gang. And so they want to take away all of Lieutenant Daniels' force, all of his team members. And finally, the vindictive deputy operations officer says, oh, I'll let you keep 2. Who do you want to keep? And Daniels isn't stupid. He doesn't put out his mouth. But the deputy ops decides, you know, I'm going to let you keep Przybylowski and Freeman, you know, from the pawn shop and the and the screw up son-in-law of the district commander. And, you know, Daniels in his eyes, you know, there is this palpable relief that he has the two guys he really needs
yes.
to keep this going.
Yeah, absolutely. Next gut punch moment for me. I would say as far as gut punch moments, episode 3 with Dee teaching the crew how to play chess and realizing what the fate of the characters long term is likely to be. That was the first. Second was in episode 6 when we get a long shot that as soon as I started watching it, to me was reminiscent of The West Wing. It's a shot of yeah. Wallace waking up and camera following him through the apartment in one continuous walking shot as he's waking up and brushing his teeth and getting ready for the day and walking into a room where he flicks on a light and starts yelling for some people to wake up. And you find out it's this whole room full of kids, 6 to 8 younger kids that he's waking up and he's kicking out the door to go to school. And it becomes apparent that he is in some way taking responsibility and caring for these kids. And I don't think it's ever made clear in the season, or if it was, I missed it, what exactly his relationship is to these kids. I don't know if it's just little kids he's taking care of because they need someone, or if they're like his younger brothers and sisters or something. But he's kicking them out the door to school, and they're living in an apartment that doesn't actually have electricity. He's got just a really long extension cable strung across that's pulling electricity in for lights and whatnot. And he's handing them juice boxes and bags of potato chips to take as either their lunch or their snack for the school day. And being a dad with kids and contrasting what my kids have with what Wallace's kids have, and Wallace himself at just 15 or 16 years old, maybe just 14, taking care of all of these kids. That was just a gut punch to me of kind of a microcosm of life on the streets and the tragedy of life on the streets.
Yeah, I mean, I believe it. If you say it hit you harder, I think it hit my friend Sam harder too. But it was hard to watch for me as well. Yeah, I think they're just having read The Corner, which is David Simon's nonfiction account of life on the streets. You know, I would imagine that some are directly related, some are farther relations, you know, brothers and sisters, and then you've got your cousins or you've got your friends of cousins. That community, if you would, runs together a little bit. Yeah, no, it's powerful.
Next moment, episode 8, McNulty's out shopping in a market in West Baltimore, and Stringer Bell walks in, and McNulty, who, by the way, for people who don't know, is divorced and has 2 kids that he's sharing custody with his wife, so he only gets to see them occasionally, and only if he's on his best behavior. He's out at the market with his kids, having a day with them, and sees Stringer Bell in the market, and makes the questionable decision to assign his kids to tail Stringer Bell through the market, which, to be clear, he's been training his kids on surveillance techniques. So this isn't completely out of the blue. You can argue about whether or not he even should have been training his kids on surveillance techniques, but whatever. It's fun. I think if I'd been a kid, I would have thought that would have been a fun activity in general. But sending his kids to tail Stringer Bell, I was worried for the kids. That was a tense scene for me. I'm picturing it. It's a gritty show already, and I'm picturing just having to see Stringer Bell whack the kids in some way or another. And that was a tense moment.
Oh, that's interesting. It was mainly comedy for me. I don't know why it hit me differently, but I assumed that nothing was going to come of it. I mean, obviously, this man is a bad father. In some ways, having your kids tail a drug kingpin's number one lieutenant.
I mean, in some way, you know they're safe because Stringer Bell's going to keep his own cans clean. He's not going to be whacking the kids in the market. But in the other sense, you know, you sometimes wonder about what are the longer term repercussions if Stringer Bell catches on that he's being tailed.
Yeah, okay, sure. Yeah. it's a great scene.
It is.
Follows up them ended up having their day with Dad and Omar.
McNulty is a parent. You feel for him wanting to see his kids, and you also sort of wonder if his wife isn't right and perhaps he shouldn't be allowed to see his kids.
Yeah, this is maybe a good comparison with Leo, whose ability to stay in his job is probably indefensible, but we love him and we see his and we understand his staff's love for him, so we're kind of on his side anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Next moment, episode 10, Judge Phelan has been helping McNulty get this case running and has been applying outside pressure on the police department to keep the case running and to keep it from getting shut down. Judge Phelan's been backing them at every turn, but we found out earlier that Judge Phelan is up for re-election, and the local party had kind of not put their support behind him for re-election, hadn't campaigned against him, but just hadn't given him any support at all. And then we get a scene at a fundraiser in episode 10 where suddenly Judge Phelan's name and picture is back on the list of candidates to support, and he's suddenly not giving support to the case that he had been giving before. He's inclined to say, hey, we've gone far enough. We've accomplished enough. We don't really need to keep pushing. And it's then that you realize that political pressure, even though Judge Phelan has looked like this strong, independent voice of doing the right thing, that he's a guy just like anybody else, and he's been doing the right thing because he's been enjoying his position as judge and been enjoying the opportunity to push the police department around. But when it comes right down to it and his own future is at stake, in contrast to the West Wing, he's not going to do the right thing. He's not going to push even when it hurts him. He's going to back down and play ball and do what it takes to survive. Very realistic, and I can't say I really fault Judge Phelan for his actions, but very clear difference between the two shows.
Yeah, that's a good point. You don't get a whole lot of actual politicians in this season of The Wire, but what you do see draws a contrast with what you see in the West Wing.
So skipping over a bullet point in my notes, we'll just jump to episode 13, where we're doing kind of a wrap-up. Large chunk of the Barksdale gang has been arrested, and the prosecutors are talking with the defense attorneys about what's going to go down. And instead of getting a whole Law and Order kind of thing where we go to a trial and have some dramatic court moments, we just have a dealing between two prosecutors and a defense attorney that results in a whole bunch of people being in a room in front of a judge and reading off a long list of stipulated facts and agreed upon sentences. And you just do this long plea bargain thing where some people get off a heck of a lot lighter than they should. Some people get off worse than they should, and the whole thing's kind of wrapped up in what you assume is like a 2-hour long session in a courtroom. And that's American justice for you. Gather the evidence, do a plea deal, and move on.
Yeah, I like that verisimilitude very much. And it's always interesting again to see the maneuvering on the other side of the fence that leads to a lot of these people getting off fairly light. Probably the one of the lightest sentences is handed down to the gang member who actually ends up shooting a police officer during all of this. And there's really not much of it. You know, that sort of violence throughout the story. But I think he gets 5 years.
That sounds about right. Yeah,
exactly.
No, and it illustrates which we have a romantic view of the American justice system, that it seeks out and prosecutes and punishes the evildoer. And there's so many cop shows that are idealized versions of reality in which you do get the investigation and then the trial and the prosecution. And the reality is that something like 90 or 95% of all cases in the American court system end in plea bargains. And it was jarring to see that on screen, because that isn't normally something that you see on screen. And so to have this entire 12-episode show wrap up with what is maybe a cumulative 7 minutes of screen time on the plea bargains was very abrupt, very jarring, and I think very effective at communicating, hey, the American justice system is not what you would like to believe it is.
Right. Even for a very, liberal sort of Black Lives Matter sort of person, you know, you see really misjustice carried in all sort of ways, and injustice not motivated by what you would like it to be motivated by, for that matter, being one of the great themes of the series. I like it. It's an effective scene. And of course, at the end of it, I think McNulty repeats one of his catchphrase, but with an entirely different sense to it. What the F did I do?
Right.
Usually in this sort of defensive, funny way, but this time, you know, he's kind of looking around at all that happened and wondering whether he had made the right choice by rolling the ball downhill in the first place.
Right. Did he actually accomplish something that was worth it for the amount of effort that he expended and the amount of enemies that he made? Which leads right into, he gets called into the major's office.
You're a good detective. I gotta admit, you got some stones on you. Did you actually call the first deputy in that empty suit? I want to see you land okay, Jimmy. So tell me, where don't you want to go?
And the scene just ends before he gives his answer. But you've had the setup in episode 1 and in episode 4 that you pretty much know exactly what's going to happen as a result of that conversation. Once you have that scene, it was a great tying a bow, tying the last episode to the first episode and putting it all together.
Yeah, it's a good finish, a good punchline. And I'm glad it all came back to you. The humor and the thing is about, I'm so glad that all that came flooding back to you. With regard to his hatred for the Marine unit, it's funny. The Wire is not one to really flag their jokes. There are scenes that are supposed to be funny that you don't even necessarily realize, at least in my case, are supposed to be funny. David Simon's really big on not telling you how to feel. And in fact, in season 2, he kind of sorts out and perfects the approach he's using. Like in this first season, there's a few slow motion moments, and, you know, a few directorial toys that are played with, and you actually never see those again. Yeah, he from now on, there are rules. Only if there's music playing, it's because it's ambient music, like, you know, the source of it, and that sort of thing. So I was reading up on this after watching the episodes again, and I was surprised to learn that one scene was supposed to be funny. And maybe just because of my feelings about the subject matter, you know, I didn't get that memo, if you would. And that's fine. But I find that interesting.
Well, and it's it's interesting you mentioned David Simon not telling you how to feel. It's something I've been noticing a lot more. I've been occasionally watching old sitcom episodes. More often than not, Frasier, but occasionally Home Improvement or others from the 90s. And the degree to which there's a laugh track in those shows is really kind of jarring after all the TV I've been watching. That these are shows that really hit you over the head with the fact that that was supposed to be funny. You're supposed to be laughing right now. Join in the rest. Join. Laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's jarring, and it's watching The Wire, where you get to have your own feelings about the show, and whether it's humor or whether it's tragedy is kind of up to your reaction to what's on screen. It's not the director or the writer trying to force it upon you.
Right. Man, I can't even watch or really enjoy those laugh track sitcoms now. There's the occasional new era of sitcoms that don't employ that sort of technique that I can enjoy now and then. I think I enjoyed episodes of The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt and the Bee in Apartment 23 and a few others, but those laugh tracks drive me insane.
It makes you suddenly wonder, makes me suddenly wonder, what would it be like to watch a show where you use some kind of audio processing utility to strip out the laugh track and watch it without the laugh track? How would that change the experience of watching the episode?
I think that experiment is a YouTube video away from you. In fact, I'm sure that someone's done that. Give it a look, because I know I've watched something like that before.
Coming up on episode 16 of The Golden Age with Vox Duo.
Sitcoms would actually be interesting. We generally stick to dramas and more serious stuff, if Captain America is considered serious, but sitcoms or something of the like might be interesting.
So, Adam, did that joke really work for you? Let's break it down and talk about the theory of humor and whether or not this particular joke nailed the five elements that are essential to a good sitcom joke.
That doesn't sound fun at all. Never mind.
Moving right along. So, yeah, wrapping up The Wire for me. You talked about the parts of The West Wing that were jarring and were downsides. I couldn't really come up with anything for The Wire. I'm sure there were technical flaws or there were other flaws in the show, but it was largely a show I enjoyed from start to finish. And I think anything I would complain about in it would be complaints about reality, and you only get so far complaining about reality. So I'm just kind of skip over that whole part of the discussion because I don't really feel like I have anything to say there.
So I'm curious then, how quickly did you gain a handle on who all these people were? Because you could be forgiven for thinking in episode one, who are all these people? You know, there's just so many faces introduced. And I know it took me and my wife a few episodes to get a hold on it.
Yeah, fair enough. I think if you were going to make a critique of the show, the huge cast size might be part of it. It didn't really bother me. In some degree, I guess I expect a police department and a prosecutorial division and a drug gang to be filled with a huge amount of people. And since I was looking at this as a realistic show to begin with, that was just another aspect of the show that matched reality. You know, going back to what you'd said about West Wing, about no executive branch actually is populated by just five main people. If the West Wing had had a huge cast, that would have been a problem. If The Wire had had a small cast, I also think that would have been a problem. This was a show that needed a large cast to feel realistic, at least in my opinion.
Okay, fair enough. Did you feel...
Which isn't to say that I knew who everybody was, because I spent a large portion of the show trying to remember who is this guy now? Did we see him in an earlier episode? Am I supposed to remember something about him? But it didn't really bother me.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, that's how I felt too, that I was still enjoying myself, even if occasionally I was confused. And that did happen. Like, once my wife asked me during this third viewing of season one who somebody was, and honestly, I did not know.
He's just a guy, you know? Just a guy.
I mean, yeah, he's one of the gang members, which is all you really needed to know, but still.
But is he one of the good gang members or one of the bad gang members?
You just shut up and watch the episode. Gosh, you know how I don't like talking.
Exactly. I think the other thing, we've already talked about it a little bit, is how much of a business the drug trade is. It's just an extra legal business that operates without the protection and the assistance that other businesses get from having ready access to the police and to the court system. But there are multiple moments in the show where it's brought home that what Avon Barksdale and Stringer Bell is running is a business, and they're attempting to operate it in the most business-like way that they can outside of the law. And, you know, as you'd mentioned, there's the remarks from Dee about how it's the bodies. If it wasn't for the bodies, they wouldn't be hassling us. Why can't we do it without the bodies and just buy and sell like anybody else? But there's also a moment in one of the later episodes, somewhere from 7 to 9, I think, where Stringer Bell's operating inside of a copy shop, something similar to a Kinko's. And it's apparently a front business for the drug gang, a place to launder the money. But he's criticizing the guys who are there for not acting more professional, because they're wanting to just be as rude to the customers as they can be, because, heck, it's not like we actually need customers in this place. And Stringer Bell's chewing them out for not being more professional. If the customer comes in, the customer gets what he wants, and you be nice. And it to me, that was one of those scenes that made it very obvious. He wants to be a businessman. He's got organizational skills. He's got problem-solving, troubleshooting skills. He wants to be a businessman. It just so happens that his chosen profession is one that's outside the law and doesn't let him act quite the way he would like to, but he's still going to keep it as professional as he can. And to me, it was just another nudge in the direction of, you know, how much different would things be if we got rid of the drug war and all of these people could operate inside of the legal system rather than outside of the legal system.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's definitely one of the running themes of the whole show, you know, the absurdity and also the tragedy of the drug war and how it's caught people between these two situations. You know, that's a great scene with Stringer too.
Oh, it is. It is.
Fresh out of his college course.
I forgot about that. Yes, he was. McNulty tailed him one night and found out he was going to community college. And McNulty was tailing him through the halls trying to figure out what kind of clandestine meeting he was having at a community college. And it turns out he's in an MBA class and he's answering questions and sounding quite studious. And way on top of the material. And that's when you really get the impression Stringer Bell is not just, he's not just a street thug. He's got plans.
He does. And you learn more about them in the future seasons.
So that brings me to the two things I wanted to discuss or ask you about to wrap up. One, McNulty is talking to his sergeant in episode one. And the sergeant talks about where don't you want to go? And McNulty says, the River Unit. And he has the conversation in episode four about being careful of questions like that, which, okay, he's already kind of blown it. And then you see him at the end assigned to the River Unit. And this may be answered in later seasons. I'm curious because I think I could make an argument that McNulty doesn't mind the River Unit and was setting himself up for the inevitable fall way back at the beginning of the show. Do we know, does McNulty actually hate the River Unit? Did he end up where he didn't want to be? Or was he seeing five steps ahead of everyone else right at the beginning and set himself up for a place he didn't mind going?
I guess that's in the eye of the beholder, but that's honestly a radical interpretation to me. I've never talked or read anyone who thought that McNulty just didn't make a mistake there. You know, he's clever or really good at his job, but he's not a master of the political game. He's more of a bull in a china shop.
Yeah, and I still lean towards the interpretation he ended up where he didn't want to be because he shot off his mouth in episode one and wasn't thinking through what he was saying and who he was saying it to. I just didn't know if that was something that was made explicit in any later seasons, that, oh, he's out having the time of his life on the river unit, or, no, he's ready to throw himself off the boat and into the river because he hates what he's doing.
Yeah, I can't swear by it, but I think it's made pretty clear in season two that he wants off the boat.
And so that was going to be my next question, was I'm definitely planning on continuing. Season one got me hooked. Like you said, season one is a complete story. I could stop here and not feel like I'm missing anything because we got everything wrapped up. But I'm planning on going forward. And what do I expect for seasons 2 through 5? Same cast of characters, different cast of characters, similar, you know, more investigations into the gang, or is it just kind of, hey, here's the story of McNulty as he bounces around from place to place in Baltimore? and spoiler free, answer all of those questions without giving me a hint of what's going on.
Yeah, okay. Boy, this is the sort of question that Wire fans are just, you know, have always wanted to be asked. So, take, you know, using this comparison of a season to a novel is probably a good idea. Season one is the successful first novel. Seasons 2 and 3 are when the author decides he wants to write a trilogy. And yet seasons 3 and 4 are considered the best seasons. I think 4 is considered the best critically. But, you know, especially if you're just into the ongoing stories of these characters, I think, you know, 3 is probably a super high water mark. So you've got, once you get into season two, I don't think you're going to want to stop at the end of season two. I mean, I think that you're going to have to go all the way through and see how some of this stuff ends.
Fantastic.
Yeah. As far as casts of characters, do I just let it hit you like an oncoming truck that you didn't see coming, or what? But
I'm gonna give my predictions, and maybe you just give me a thumbs up, thumbs down here.
We see
more of McNulty because he's obviously the irascible protagonist that nobody wants to let go. So we're gonna see more of McNulty. Stringer Bell's gonna be back, less because I think Stringer Bell has to be back than because I know Idris Elba hit a huge height of popularity as a result of this show. And I don't think what I've seen in season one would be enough to say, oh yeah, that obviously made him a cult star. So I think,
right.
I think Idris Elba is back because Idris Elba isn't yet Idris Elba.
Yeah, they both are. And you can tell, the first season that McNulty is so enraged that they fail to catch Stringer Bell that, you know, you've got a setup there.
Exactly. And Omar, we end season one on Omar sticking up a drug dealer in the Bronx. At least I think it's the Bronx. And Omar is a character I've heard enough cultural chatter about that, again, I don't think I've seen enough Omar to justify the cultural chatter that I've heard. And so my suspicion is that Omar is back as well.
Yeah, you see all of the season one characters again, certainly all the main ones. So here's the thing about The Wire. Each season, well, the season one is sort of a baseline, but each season kind of takes on another angle and explores another part of the city and what's causing these problems. And so consequently, its cast grows by about 50%. Per season.
as if it wasn't large enough.
Yes. It doesn't forget about the people that it has, but you're going to get a whole new set of characters in season two, which, you know, makes sense in part because you would expect in The Wire for there to be another case opened at some point, right? And
right.
For this... But yeah, brace yourself, because this goes from being a novel on television to being a Russian novel on television.
Which is suddenly a genre of TV I didn't know that I was missing, but now I'm thinking of the Russian equivalent to Spanish telenovelas, only with all of the angst and brooding introspection that Russian novels are known for. And this is suddenly a thing that the world needs to have more of.
It needed to have at least one, and The Wire is it.
There you go. So I think that sums up my thoughts on The Wire. It's a show I'm hugely grateful to you for introducing me to and pushing me to watch, because I don't think I would have ever ended up watching it otherwise, but I think I'm coming out a winner for this exchange.
I'm glad you think so. And I am very happy with The West Wing too. As I may have said before, but it definitely fulfills that need for a show that my wife isn't interested in, but which is really good and also biteable in chunks, like and something that I can watch in the space of an hour, and then maybe not need to binge for another few days. All right, man. Well, this has been a very fun project, and next time I'm in need of a show, we'll just have to do it again.
Absolutely. Glad to be talking to you.
All right. Take care, Joe.
If you liked the show, help new listeners find it by listening to The Golden Age and rating it in Apple Podcasts. Just go into Apple Podcasts, subscribe to The Golden Age, and rate it. You can also see announcements for new shows, episodes, and upcoming live streams by following @FromVoxDuo on Twitter. Joe blogs at minorthoughts.com and is on Twitter @JMartinDF. Adam is on Twitter as well, @AdamVolle. That's Adam, V-O-L-L-E.
A good serial TV show is hard to find.
Yes.
The last one that I held on to for a while was The Blacklist on the recommendation of a friend. But I don't know. I think maybe it's just that there are so many police procedurals out there, but it just didn't break in far enough away from the pack for me. Whereas The West Wing, there's always something they're interesting talking about.
Yeah, certain shows you see advertised and you're like, did we really need 199th entry in the genre X list of shows? And my answer is usually no, we probably didn't.
Yeah, I'm curious, really. I wonder if I'm just a snob and there's actually some great stuff out there, or whether The Wire is the last cop show I ever need to watch.
Well, for cop comedies, if you haven't been watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine, you probably owe it to yourself to watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I do find that show hilarious. It is also
I'm a huge Terry Crews fan. I really should.
You should. It's pretty much the direct opposite of The Wire in every conceivable sense. So it's got that going for it.
I'll bet.
And, you know, maybe one of those palate cleansing shows that you and Anna end up enjoying together. Who knows?
We should probably try that. I've heard a lot of good things about it. You know, actually, I should qualify what I just said. A show that's actually where the police, the job is front and center. Like, because there's plenty of great television that's come out since, in which the fact that there are cops trying to solve a crime is the structure on which you're hanging the fun stuff. For example, oh, what was that? That 6-part or 8-part procedural set in Louisiana called? You know the one I'm talking about.
Nope.
Oh, really? Hold on. If I can find it real quick. It's the one with Matthew McConaughey.
Matthew McConaughey is an actor actually that's gotten progressively more interesting to me, just given the diversity of his roles.
Right.
Playing, you know, redneck schmucks up to suave guys, and doing both of them really well. Like, it's like there's no snobbiness to his role selection. He will play anybody in a way that doesn't seem to necessarily be true of other actors. And that's made him more interesting to me.
There definitely came a point where you could tell that he decided he was done being the romantic comedy lead.
Right.
But he seems, maybe it's just because of the roles he has or his personality, but he seems to be less intent on that Oscar gold than Leonardo DiCaprio was. Like,
yeah, and maybe that's it. He's playing characters that are maybe more culturally unsavory than anything. I don't know how to put it in words, but he's playing more interesting characters. Like, he's just interested in doing a good story, not necessarily in whether it's going to win him acclaim.
Mm. Okay, I've got it. 2014, Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey in True Detective.
Ah, okay.
That was a very good show. and I've done him one season. One of the really, it's a real shame that True Detective second season flopped, because I loved the idea of this premium, well-written, movie-level production quality cop show in which the cast changed every time, and that the only thing that actually remained the same was the writer and maybe the director. But the first season,
I do remember hearing about that concept, and I heard that everybody loved the first season and then nobody loved the second season.
Yeah, I wasn't so harsh on it myself. I thought the last episode kind of let things down. But until then, I didn't know why everyone was so mad about it. But the first season of True Detective is well known to be excellent.
Unfortunately, it looks like it's maybe the end of MoviePass. So,
yeah, I saw they're going to start limiting you to 3 movies a month rather than 1 a day.
Which, you know, is much better than they've been casting about, like, flailing, trying to figure out a model that works.
How to not bleed money like crazy.
Right, and the first one they came up with was like, yeah, I'm going to end up canceling this. And then I think the second one was too. I just hadn't gotten around to it. This was all like over a weekend. And now they're saying 3 movies a month for $15, which frankly sounds fine to me.
I mean, $5 a movie is not a bad deal.
No. But I'm not sure whether they may have been mortally wounded by how badly last month went, so we'll see if they last.
Well, I gotta say, it's been one of the all-time great deals for consumers at the expense of investors, because as soon as MoviePass announced their thing, one movie a day for $10 a month, you're like, there's no way the finances on that ever end up as anything but an utter disaster. But hey, if the investors are going to shovel money at you to watch films, take it while you can.
Yeah, I think of it as a rare instance of wealth redistribution.
Free market wealth redistribution at that. Something you don't see all that often.
Yep. Someone fuck. beg pardon. Screwed this. We're not recording anymore, are we?
No.
Screwed up, and we were all the benefit. For one glorious year in America, everyone got to see movies for just about free. We'll be talking about this when we're old.
It's going to be an MBA case study. The time that someone thought you could give away a huge amount of money and make a profit while doing it.
Yeah, I don't know. They got their numbers really confused. Or maybe, I don't know, I could even see, like, if they'd done it initially, maybe if they put the brakes on it sooner and had a better plan for extracting.
You know the way you make money off of this is you advertise it as a movie a day for $10 a month, and then you put in the fine print as, yeah, like the 7th bullet point of the fine print, that it only applies to art house movies.
There you go. I mean, they tried that essentially. The first thing they did was starting introducing peak times, like where you have to pay something, and that was reasonable to me. Like, I'll see all my movies at 11 a.m.
Right.
And, you know, if I can't get essentially watch for a movie for free on Friday night when Infinity War has just come out, then whatever.
Right.
But, no, they really didn't quite make it work.